A few weeks ago, I told you that my wife, Rachel, and I rescued a dog shortly after we were married. I was initially opposed to the idea of getting a dog. I think I shared that was the first major fight of our marriage and the first one that I lost. I wish I could say it was the last one that I lost, but there have been others. So we rescued this dog from a local shelter, and the dog had a variety of issues. Mostly it was really afraid of everybody. It warmed up pretty quickly to Rachel, but it remained very scared of me. So what would often happen is the dog would be sitting with Rachel on the couch, and I'd walk in the room when the dog would lift up its head, see me, stand up, jump off the couch, and trot into the other room to escape me. And this kind of started hurting my feelings. I mean, it's like, this dog doesn't even like me. What kind of a person might I be? But eventually, the dog and I started to get over it, and we started to bond, and this dog became a pretty integral part of our family. And with Rachel and I, the dog really became very comfortable. So we love this dog. But what happened is that the fear issues that he had turned into aggression with other people. And so the dog started to bite other people, and several people we'd had watch him ended up getting bit, and then we got pregnant. Mostly Rachel got pregnant, but we were going to have a baby, and we realized we couldn't have a dog like this with a baby. We couldn't have a dog that bit people with a baby running around that didn't know how to handle things. And so we tried to get the dog away, to find a new home for him, but it's hard to find a home for a dog that is either terrified of you or bites you. And so we realized that we had to put this dog to sleep. And so we did. And I remember so vividly going to the veterinarian, being in the room with him as he got the first shot, and then holding my hand on him with the second shot, and him slowly falling asleep and passing, and then driving home and just sobbing uncontrollably in the car at the loss of this family member, really, that had been a part of our lives, that we'd gone through stuff. Saying goodbye is never easy. There's this hole that's left when you have to say goodbye to somebody. We're in the midst of a series during Lent now in the Upper Room Discourse of the Gospel of John. It's part of our larger year-long series that we've been doing through the entire Gospel. We began that in September. We'll finish it in June. And we've been seeing Jesus through the eyes of this Gospel author. During this series in the Upper Room Discourse, we've seen Jesus preparing his disciples for his leaving. We saw him start off by washing his disciples' feet, this act of service to them. We've seen Jesus talking about what it looks like to be a friend of God, defining their relationship in terms of friendship. Last week, we saw Jesus preparing his disciples to suffer, to be persecuted, to experience hatred even, because of their fellowship with him. And this morning, we come to the last moments of Jesus' interaction with his disciples. Next week, we'll end this section by seeing Jesus pray to the Father for his disciples. But this week, we see his last words with his disciples, the last conversation they have together. Jesus says goodbye to his disciples, and they say goodbye to him. And so as we study this passage, we're going to be thinking about what it means to say goodbye to Jesus. Throughout the Upper Room Discourse, we've repeatedly observed this one idea that Jesus is preparing his disciples to be without his physical presence. And yet what he's preparing them to experience is the same thing that we have always experienced. We have never known what it's like to walk with Jesus, to have his physical presence with us. All we've known is the state that he is teaching his disciples about in these words. So as he prepares them, he's also speaking to us to help us understand how to interact with God, how to be without Jesus. And in this final conversation, he wants to help them to understand what it's going to be like. He starts off by telling them what it's going to feel like to not have him around. And then he tells them that things between them and God are going to change because he's leaving. And he helps them to understand what it's going to be like to worship without Jesus around. And finally, he helps them to understand how to believe, what to think, what their faith is going to look like without them around. He helps them understand emotionally how to be without him. spiritually how to be without them, and intellectually how to be without Jesus. And so for us, these words describe the condition that we're in, and they help us to make sense of our own feelings, our own worship, our own thoughts, help us to understand how to bring those to God. Looking at John 16, verses 16 through 33 this morning, I'm going to start by reading the first several verses of those. This is John 16, verses 16 through 22. He begins by being really honest about how difficult life's going to be without him, about how hard goodbyes are. But he wants to prepare them for a certain type of emotional experience. Here's verses 16 through 22. "A little while," he says, "and you will see me no longer. And again a little while, and you will see me." So some of his disciples said to one another, "What is this that he says to us? A little while, and you will not see me, and again a little while, and you will see me, and because I am going to the Father." So they're saying, "What does he mean by a little while? We do not know what he is talking about." Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. So he said to them, "Is this what you are asking yourselves, what I meant by saying, a little while and you will not see me, and again a little while and you will see me? Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also, you have sorrow now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you." Jesus begins by telling his disciples about leaving for a little while, and then after a little while, coming back. And the disciples get confused about this, and Jesus is pretty savvy, so he picks up that they're confused, and he says, "Oh, are you asking this question?" And they're all going, "Yes, that's exactly what we're asking." And then he doesn't answer it. Instead, he tells them something else. Instead, he describes their emotions. See, the disciples want details. They want to understand the timeline, and it's worth asking, why doesn't Jesus give them that? He could have said, "About 5 p.m. tomorrow, I'm going to die. But 10 a.m. on Sunday, I'll meet you at Starbucks. I'll be alive again, and it'll be great, and we'll have a party. So don't worry. It's just Friday to Sunday. You can do it, right? Go that long." But he doesn't give them that level of detail. He tells them a little while, and he says, "You must be wondering what I mean by this. Let me talk about this other thing now." I'm going to say, well, why doesn't he give them more? Why doesn't he give us more information? I think Jesus knows that we're going to live in this state of being without him for a while. And we're not going to have all the information we want. We're not going to know all those details. So he wants to prepare his disciples in this instance for what it's going to feel like during that in-between time without the information that they think they need. So what does he tell them? What does he want to prepare them with? He tells them that it's going to hurt, that they will grieve, that they will feel sorrow. The pain I felt saying goodbye to our first family dog, I know doesn't compare with the pain that some of you have felt saying goodbye to friends, to parents, to children. I almost hesitated telling that story because I know there is so much deeper pain that people have felt in this world. Jesus knows that, and he wants to prepare the disciples to say, it's going to be hard being without me. He says you will grieve, but he invites his disciples to grieve in a certain way. He wants them to understand that the sorrow they feel is not without purpose, and it's not without hope. He wants them to grasp that the sorrow they feel is temporary. In verse 20, he says this, "You will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. It won't last forever." And he uses this phrase, "a little while," over and over again. 7 times it's repeated in 4 verses. He wants to drill into their heads that this sorrow is only for a moment. It's a limited duration type of thing. And not only is the sorrow temporary, but the joy that's going to replace it is permanent. In verse 22, he says, "You have sorrow now, but your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you." The joy that's going to replace your temporary sorrow will last forever. Jesus wants to help his disciples know how it's going to feel when he's gone. He tells them that you have to grieve. You will feel sorrow. But he says you can grieve expectantly. You can grieve knowing that something else is coming. And what is coming is way better than what you experience now. Jesus wants us to know in our in-between state that we grieve expectantly. I've only gotten a flat tire once in my life while driving. It was about 2 a.m, and my wife was in the car. We were driving to the hospital because she was in labor with our second child. And our tire goes flat. So I did what any responsible car owner would do, right? Call AAA, wait for them to show up. You know, no, I didn't do that. I quickly realized that it'd be easier to replace the rim on my car than to find a new father for the child that was about to be born. So I kept going, drove to the hospital, destroyed the rim on that car, but it was replaced easily, and I'm still here. So that's the good news. And of course, the goal in that situation is get to the hospital as quick as possible, because my wife was in pain. I'm told the pain of childbirth is intense. Us guys like to say, we'd do it if we could, but you know, God just had other plans. So there was pain, and it was intense, but then there was a child. And now, 10 years later, there is a person in our life, a son that we love and know, and that life is so much richer and more significant than even the intensity of the pain of childbirth. This is what Jesus is talking about. This is why he uses this image. That pain is incredibly intense, but having someone new in the world is so much better. It's actually a picture that Jesus picks up from Isaiah. Isaiah uses this in chapter 26 of his book, where he describes God's people as like pregnant women in the pangs of childbirth, waiting for deliverance from the suffering of this world. Isaiah encourages them. Listen to what he says in chapter 26, verse 20. He says, "Hide yourselves for a little while until the fury has passed by." I love that phrase. He recognizes that there is something intense going on, but there is something else that will replace it that is far more significant. What is the grief that you are in the midst of right now? All of us have things we're dealing with. Maybe they're relatively minor. Maybe they're really significant. Maybe they're bigger than we realize. What are some of the things that you are feeling, some of the sorrow that you feel? I want to invite you just to take a moment. Maybe you want to write it down in your sermon notes page. Maybe you want to type it into your phone or just think about it and remember it. But to reflect, I'm not going to ask you to share this later, so this is just between you and God. But what is something that you are grieving? Some sorrow that you feel? We have to grieve. Jesus is incredibly honest about the reality of pain in this world. He says, you can't act like everything's okay. You can't rise above it and pretend like things don't bother you. You grieve, but you grieve expectantly with the hope that joy is coming. So Jesus is having this last conversation with his disciples. He's told them how it's going to feel for him to be gone. And now he starts to talk about what the relationship with God is going to be like once Jesus leaves the scene. Listen to what he says in verses 23 through 27. "In that day you will ask nothing of me. Truly, truly, I say to you, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Until now you have asked nothing in my name. Ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full." I have said these things to you in figures of speech. The hour is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figures of speech, but will tell you plainly about the Father. In that day you will ask in my name, and I do not say to you that I will ask the Father on your behalf, for the Father himself loves you, because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God. The first sentence of this section is a little bit confusing. The ESV translates two different Greek words as ask, and it leads to some confusion because it sounds like Jesus is saying, you will ask nothing of me, but then he says, talks later about what we will ask of the Father. He's probably talking about two different types of asking. The first one probably has to do with asking questions, looking for more information. The New American Standard actually translates that phrase, you will no longer question me about anything. That's probably more along the lines of what Jesus is getting at here. He's saying there will come a day when your questions about me will be answered. The second part of the verse then probably has to do with making requests of Jesus or making requests of the Father, asking for something we want, asking for things to be done. And so Jesus says there will also come a day when you will make requests of the Father in my name, and those will be granted. So Jesus speaks of a day when we won't have any questions about him and when we will get what we ask of the Father. Let's take a little poll. How many have questions you'd like to ask Jesus? Yes, me too. Now, how about this one? How many of you have asked for something from God and you haven't gotten it? Me too. So when's this day coming, right? When will all of our questions be answered and everything we want we get? Well, I think it's actually today. I think Jesus is speaking of this day, and we have to understand what exactly he's describing. First, Jesus is saying that we will understand who he is. And while it's true that there are questions left I'd love to ask Jesus, we really know a lot about Jesus. What he's describing is that the Spirit has helped God's people to put all the pieces together. We understand who he is. We understand why he came. We understand all of the basics of this man who is God. In the 4th century AD, under the guidance of the Spirit, there's a group of church leaders who came together to put some language around that understanding. They drafted what we now call the Nicene Creed. They describe Jesus as begotten, not made. They say that Jesus is one being with the Father, that he came down from heaven for us and for our salvation, that he suffered death and was buried, that he rose again and ascended into heaven, and that he will come again in glory. In the 16 centuries since those words were written, nobody has really argued with them. Nobody within Orthodox Christianity has said, no, that we have some new information, or that's not quite the way it is. We really do understand who Jesus is. And that's an incredible thing, that our little minds can grasp the purposes of God in coming to earth incarnate. And that leads to the second point. Because we know who Jesus is, we can expect that when we ask things of the Father in his name, we will be granted them. Now, if I were a teenager today, I would be a huge fan of the Harry Potter books. I love the idea of a magic wand. You know, you just wave it and you get what you want. I remember fantasizing about that as a kid. I would read fantasy novels and science fiction novels, and the idea of like having some tool to just accomplish my will, no matter what it is, was so exciting. And I think that's how we're tempted to read this verse. We think that Jesus is saying, God will be your magic wand. You just wave around, in Jesus' name, amen, and zap, you get what you want. But that can't be what Jesus is talking about here. I know some of you, and I don't think I'd want to live in a world where you get whatever you want. Some of you know me, and I know you wouldn't want to live in a world where I get whatever I want. There have to be limits. There has to be a structure in which we're able to get our requests. And so what Jesus is talking about is not every possible wish, every whim of our hearts receive. What he's saying is within God's will, within the purposes that God has for the world, we have the ability to influence the outcome. We are partners with God in what he is doing on our planet. And that is an incredible thing. Later in the Bible, the same gospel author says this again and clarifies it a little bit. Listen to 1 John 5, verses 14 to 15. He says, "This is the confidence that we have toward him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the requests that we have asked of him." John's talking about a relationship with Jesus and a participation in God's purposes for the world. And it might sound like he's saying, well, you can ask for anything as long as God was going to do it anyway. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying that God has a plan for this world. But within that plan, there is great flexibility. There are a whole lot of details. And the amazing truth is that because of our relationship with God, we can affect those details. You see this all throughout the Old Testament, all throughout the New Testament. Believers in God making requests of him and God changing the way he would otherwise do stuff because they asked. That's incredible that God gives us the right to affect his plan for the world. Jesus puts these two ideas together. He says, you know me, and because you know me, you have the type of relationship that you can entrust me with your requests. You can ask to the Father in my name. And so he invites us then to ask for what we want, to bring our requests, to make them known, to come before God, knowing who he is, and because of that, having a confidence that God will treat our requests well. We can ask confidently of God. Asking for what you want is one of the most dangerous things you can do. Asking is a great risk. I recently listened to a TED talk on vulnerability where the speaker was talking about the things that make people feel the most vulnerable. She had collected a list of them, and almost every single one had to do with asking for something that you want. Asking someone out on a date. Initiating sex with your spouse. Asking for a raise or a promotion. Interviewing for a job. Making an offer on a house. Asking for what we want is terrifying because as soon as we make a request, we open ourselves up to disappointment. We open ourselves up to that terrible word, no. And most of us really don't like that word. Asking something of someone is risky. It's vulnerable. Because if we're truly asking, then we're giving that person the freedom to say yes or no. Jesus is saying we can come to God and ask him for what we want. A lot of people think that God likes saying no, that his default response is just no, 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 oh, and no. But that's not the way God is. Jesus says God actually wants to say yes. We don't have to trick him into saying yes. We don't have to manipulate him. God wants us to ask things of him, and within his will, he will say yes to us. What is something that you want? Maybe it's something that you're afraid to ask for. Maybe you think you don't deserve it, that it's just too incredible. Or maybe you've been disappointed before and you're afraid to open yourself up to vulnerability again. I asked you to consider something that you are grieving. Now I'd like to ask you to consider a request you might make of God. Again, maybe you want to write it down or record it somehow or just remember it. But think of something that you would ask of God. Jesus says that we can ask confidently, not because we know we will get exactly what we want, but because we know who Jesus is, and we can trust him with our requests. So So Jesus is saying goodbye to his disciples. He's described to them the emotional state of being without him. He's described how worship is going to look like when Jesus is gone. And now he turns to faith. He helps them to realize what they're going to think without him. Here's verses 28 to 33. I came from the Father and have come into the world, and now I am leaving the world and going to the Father. His disciples said, Ah, now you are speaking plainly and not using figurative speech. Now we know that you know all things and do not need anyone to question you. This is why we believe that you came from God. Jesus answered them, Do you now believe? Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and you will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world. The first verse of this section is a great summary of the ministry of Jesus. He says, I started with the Father, I came down to earth, now I am leaving earth, and I'm returning to the Father. It's a great closing of the circle. And yet that process has accomplished so much. And at this point, the disciples get excited. They finally figure it out, and they realize what is one of the primary points of who Jesus is all throughout the Gospel of John. They say, we finally get it. We believe that you have come from God, that you are a representative of the creator of the universe. All throughout the gospel, this has been a big deal for people to understand this. In John 3, verse 2, Nicodemus recognizes this. He says, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God. Later in chapter 9, verse 16, the Pharisees question this very point. They say, How can a man, they say, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. And then in verse 3 of chapter 13, Jesus, secure in his own knowledge of this, is able to go to work. He says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given him all things into his hands and that he had come from God. There's about 10 other places in the gospel where this phrase comes up, because this is one of the biggest things the gospel author John wants us to understand about Jesus. He has come from God to earth for our sakes. And finally, the disciples get it. They say, we believe this. We get it. You have come from God. And you have to feel a little bad for them, because even at this great moment of realization, Jesus challenges them. He says, oh, you think you get it? Well, you're going to be scattered pretty quickly after this. He's challenging their overconfidence, their great, oh, we finally get it. We've arrived. And he says, you haven't arrived. Yes, that's important. You believe this, but there's a lot more to learn. I think Jesus is after faith that is realistic. Faith that knows what it knows, but also understands that faith is a work in process. That there's growth, that there's development, that we've never gotten there. Jesus wants us to believe, but to be humble in our faith, to believe humbly. I've recently started coaching volleyball for my daughter, my sixth grade daughter, and it's a lot of fun. But I've observed this trend among the girls that we're coaching. There's a couple different attitudes towards instruction, and I've noticed that the better athletes tend to have a certain attitude. See, some of the girls, they see this ball, and they're totally intimidated, and they think, there's no way on earth that I will ever be able to control where this ball goes. And so I'll try and teach them, well, if you hold your feet this way and hold your arms that way and swing this way, you'll be able to control it. And they just shake their heads and hang their heads in shame, and they have no confidence that anything they could do could ever progress to being capable. Other girls think that they're already all that, and they don't need any help from a coach or anybody else. They're already volleyball stars at age 11, and they don't want to hear what I have to tell them about how to put their feet or hold their arms. They think that they've got it all figured out. But the best athletes, the ones that are learning and growing, they have a confidence that if I work at this, And if I put into practice some things, I'll improve. So they're willing to listen to me and the other coaches, and they're willing to change, and they're willing to grow. And as they do that, that confidence builds, and then they learn more. And there's this process of growth, this humility with confidence that goes together to help them to make steps. This is the kind of attitude that Jesus is trying to develop in his disciples. Faith, belief, knowledge of certain things, coupled with an awareness that we have so much to learn, and there is so much farther to go, that we are all walking in this process. I've seen both these extremes in the church. I've seen people that think, I've got it all figured out. I know exactly what this whole God thing's about, and my job now is to just tell other people. And that works for a while, until it doesn't work. And life happens to them. And the bottom drops out, and they get confused, and they have nowhere to go because their system now wasn't as tight as they thought it was. And then there's other people, some of whom used to be that category, that have lost all confidence. And they say, this whole God thing, Jesus, it's just too much. I can't ever grasp it. Maybe they used to know what they think, but now they're discouraged. They've lost faith, or they've walked away, and they think, none of it makes sense anymore. Jesus wants us to be in this middle ground of knowing some things, knowing what we know of Jesus, but also knowing that God is at work. The first category needs to learn that faith is a process. You never get there. You never arrive. It's a relationship. The second category needs to remember that even a weak faith, even a little bit of knowledge, the tiniest hope, can grow and develop into boldness and courage. That's why Jesus ends by telling them to take heart. He says, you'll face tribulation, things are going to be hard, but everything you face, I've already defeated. I have overcome the world. I'm just asking you to stay in it until that's made final. Take heart. Keep going. Grow. Believe in humility. I've asked you to think about one thing you might be grieving, one request you might make of God. Now I'd like to ask you to write down or remember or reflect on one thing you know of Jesus. Maybe it's a little piece of information. Maybe it's something that you can cling to when other stuff seems confusing. What is one thing you believe that you know about God or about Jesus that you can believe and walk in? This passage contains the last interaction between Jesus and his disciples before he goes to the cross. It's his goodbye to them. Next week, we'll see Jesus praying for these disciples, speaking to the Father on their behalf, and it'll open up this fascinating picture of what Jesus wants for us. But this week, he speaks directly to them. It's hard to say goodbye. Saying goodbye leaves this hole. It was true for us when we lost our first dog. I know it's true for a lot of you as you have grieved and are grieving the loss of dearly loved ones. It's even harder when you don't have the chance to say goodbye. And for us, that's partly what's true of us with Jesus. We never knew what it was like to walk with him. And so living in his absence is sometimes something we forget. Sometimes we forget that we have said goodbye, that he is there, and yet we don't experience him in the way that we could and in the way that we will. But even that pain of saying goodbye is a testament to the relationship that we have. We don't miss people we don't like. Saying goodbye is hard because we want to be with those people. The pain of being without Jesus is a testament to our love for him, for the relationship we have with him. And to prepare us for that, Jesus has told us what to expect. He's told us how it's going to feel, and he says, you will grieve, but you can grieve expectantly. He's told us what our relationship with God will look like. He says, you will understand me, and because of that, you will be able to ask God confidently for what you want, trusting him with your requests. And he's told us about how we're going to believe. He helps us to see certain pieces of truth, but also to grow and develop in our faith. Throughout the morning, I've invited you to write some things down or reflect on some things. And as we close, I'd like to invite you to hold those things as we finish off the service in worship, to bring those to God, to interact with him directly. Bring him your grief. Bring him your requests. Bring him your faith, whatever it may be. Goodbye is an old contraction of the phrase, God be with ye. And when we say goodbye to Jesus, and when he says goodbye to us, this is what he's saying. He's saying, I am leaving you, but God is staying with you. You have his presence. You have a direct line to the Father now in my name. Bring him your grief, your requests, and your faith. I'd like to invite the band to come back forward and the ushers to come forward. I will pray for our offering, and then we will continue our worship service and song. God, thanks for this morning, for the chance to hear these words of Jesus speaking to his disciples, preparing them for his absence and preparing us for what life is like as we have faith. God, help us to grieve in hope, knowing that something better is coming. Help us to be willing to risk the vulnerability of asking you for what we want. And help us to believe humbly, learning and growing, being taught and corrected. God, we love you. We're so grateful that you love us. We offer you our lives, our time, our energy, and now we offer you from our finances, recognizing that they are yours to begin with, that you have entrusted them to us, and we return a portion back to you, trusting that you will use them for your purposes. We do pray all this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.